Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 113 for Tuesday, August 9th. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, Google whining about patents. Second, Apple getting sued for using a photo. And third, streaming DVDs over the internet with Zadiva got shut down in California. We'll start off with our first story, Google whining about patents. This week, Google's Senior Vice President and Chief Legal Officer David Drummond posted a long post on the Google blog basically saying, our competitors are trying to use patents to make Android more difficult to use, and more difficult for us to actually push out Android. He went into detail basically saying they were trying to do this anti-competitive strategy, banding together to get patents from companies like Novell, to make it more expensive for phone manufacturers to license Android, which Google notably gives out for free, whereas its competitors actually make money off of it. And basically, he said a bunch of stuff that was like, you guys are trying to make it really hard for us to give our product away for free to undermine your business. Microsoft's counsel actually replied on Twitter and said, well, some of the stuff you said isn't true. We actually offered to buy some of these patents with you, but you didn't want to. And Google backpedaled a little bit and was like, well, it's not surprising Microsoft would want to divert attention by pushing a false gotcha, to quote. And basically, suddenly the whole idea of software patents, especially as it relates to iOS and Android operating systems, has come under a public focus because of this blog post. Initial thoughts from the panel?
I mean, I think it's another page in an emerging debate about the role of software patents in innovation, well, in promoting innovation and in anti-competitive behavior that we're seeing among, you know, that we're finally seeing getting teased out among these tech companies. You know, as for a broader view of it, you know, there's been a lot of criticism that's come across Google's way for basically taking their dominant position in search, leveraging it into a dominant position in the cell phone in the smartphone market by giving away their operating system for free, and now they're crying foul when, you know, there were patents out there that they apparently infringe, and you know, they're saying these other people are trying to compete unfairly against us when they were just, you know, kind of doing the same thing to their competitors.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest thing that jumps out is that Google has been trying to use its monopoly in the search space to try to exert a little bit of pressure in the phone space. And then when companies resisted it, I mean, I don't think it's the best public relation moves to have one of your chief legal officers post a blog post complaining.
Yeah, it was kind of whiny.
You know, oddly enough, I think that was exactly a PR move right there. And I say that because a blog post is very informal, and they're sort of catered to a specific type of audience, and the folks that are likely to read that are just, you know, they might have certain opinions of Google, and so it was just sort of meant to, at least the way that I've read it, is that it was just meant to get some sympathy for Google. But at the same time, you don't exactly see Google going to Congress and lobbying for changes in patent reform and trying to have less software patents, because they have a gigantic portfolio already for other technologies. So it's like a weird sort of double-edged sword. They're kind of playing both sides of the argument, and they're just directing it at certain audiences.
Yeah, and the other side of this is it's not like Google, one, wasn't participating in that auction. Well, so there was one auction for patents that happened recently. That's kind of the premise of the article, where a consortium including Apple and Microsoft won those patents. Google though recently purchased 1,000 IBM patents. You know, and their claim is that they're using them only defensively. Which you gotta wonder if that's gonna be true if people start suing Google themselves as opposed to suing just the makers of the Android headsets.
In the crux of Google's argument, to quote, is a smartphone might involve as many as 250,000 largely questionable patent claims, and our competitors want to impose a tax for these dubious patents that makes Android devices more expensive for consumers. And basically, he's alleging that the competitors want to fight through litigation instead of building new features or new devices.
Well, That's kind of always been the argument there, and patents are the way we, one of several ways that people are incentivized to make new features and, better phones. It's, you can innovate through market domination, or you can innovate through, getting a patent on something. They're both currently legal ways to do it. The question is, is one, morally wrong? That's a tough call, especially when both of the players are, currently have, currently, produce items in that market. It's one thing if you've got non-practicing entities or patent trolls who are just trying to extract taxes out of people. But, if Microsoft wants to sue Google, they both have smartphones out there. I'm less concerned about that kind of lawsuit than I am about the Lodesys app developer kind of lawsuits.
An interesting fact is that Microsoft actually made more money off of licensing fees for Android patents than it made for licensing Windows 7 phone itself.
Yeah, that burns.
Ouch.
I mean, yeah, the two companies have a bit of a history. Last year, Steve Ballmer, Microsoft CEO, said that it's not like Android's free. Android has a patent fee. You do have to license patents. And Microsoft's made good on that promise, basically saying that, look, we own these patents that read on Android, and they've gone to people who make Google's Android phones and have gotten licensing fees from them, which kind of makes Android not free, because they have to pay Microsoft.
Yeah, and similarly, we have that Apple patent that reads on the very least HTC phones, or some HTC phones. So, I think we can expect to have some sort of licensing agreement between HTC and Apple, and then eventually, I imagine it would move across to other phone Android phone manufacturers like Samsung and Motorola.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example of the sort of patent that might be involved in smartphone litigation, Apple has a patent on the whole idea if you're scrolling a list with your finger on a touch screen, if you reach the bottom, you actually go past, and then it sort of bumps up. You'll notice that non-iOS phones, if they don't infringe this patent, they don't have this feature. I think on some Android devices, you scroll down, your finger keeps moving, but you get like a little orange light up at the bottom to show that you can't scroll further, but your finger keeps moving, which makes it feel really awkward and strange. So that tiny idea of you can scroll past to give that sort of more natural feeling that the scrolling follows your finger, that is patented, and Apple has the rights on that for the next 17 years or so, and no one can use it without paying Apple money or facing a lawsuit. And
I thought the Apple patent was on scrolling a iframe inside of a web page. It was
They might
more
have one on that
narrow
too.
than. Oh, okay. I guess the corollary here is that, everyone in the market, at least thus far, seems to be willing to negotiate licensing deals. So at some point, we're either going to get some sort of cancellation effect where Apple's going to owe, Google X amount in licensing, Google's going to owe Microsoft X amount of licensing, and it's going to go back and forth, and it will reduce the cost overall because, for every one, Google handset sold, it will cancel out the it will cancel out the royalties due for, Apple or against Microsoft. The problem that we'd have is if people are not willing to negotiate and actually require other companies to invent around these patents, which at the same time, isn't a terrible idea. It'd be nice if there were, ways that you can implement this that didn't require licensing fees.
Yeah, I mean, the broader debate that some people are trying to raise is whether we should have even have some of these ideas patentable, because of the nature of the software industry with sort of faster moving technology, the idea that you can take an idea and lock it up for 17 years seems kind of insane.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, I had a similar thought, except for a much longer term, when it came to copyright with regard to old console games. So for an extended period of time, there was this gap between when you could really no longer get a Nintendo Entertainment System, but you could emulate it on, your computer. And there was a period of, I don't know, probably better part of a decade where, there were very few functioning Nintendo Entertainment Systems around. You could get the ROMs and play them on your computer. You just couldn't do it legally. And my thought here was, the copyright in computer games is really doing a disservice at this point in time, because no one can legally play these games anymore because there aren't functioning consoles, but there are these functioning ROMs around. However, a lot of these companies, Nintendo specifically, have now baked in this emulation into their more recent consoles. For, I don't know, $5 or something, I can go and download The Legend of Zelda and play it on my Wii, which I think is a success of copyright after there was this long gap where there was a failure, which is, in some ways, I mean, it's not a perfect analogy to patents here, but it's the same sort of thing. If people are willing to provide the good, in this case, licenses that the other people want, it's a way around this patent gridlock.
I don't think it'd be in the interest of the tech industries to have a giant patent, massive, everyone suing everyone, because that's just going to have everyone lose effectively.
Right.
I mean, we do see some lawsuits, but nothing of the sort of big lawsuits that would potentially snarl everything up for years.
I mean, lawsuits are one thing, but licensing and royalty fees are an entirely different. It's really expensive, of course, to go through a lawsuit for patent infringement, regardless of what side you're on, whether you're the plaintiff or the defendant. But if you do have a very large patent portfolio and for whatever reason, you believe those patents to be strong, and they're very relevant to, say, the smartphone market. You're going to have it's this kind of a mixture of the mutually assured destruction mentality, and also that if enough people believe the patent would be valid or held valid in a court, so they don't want to challenge it, they're probably more likely to pay licensing fees. And so there are at least some patents out there, I would imagine quite a few, where it just makes more sense to, pay the licensing and royalty fees.
Yeah,
So
and
I sort of like when I read the stories in the on the tech blogs and stuff, and when people are talking about the lawsuits, I think of those as being different than the licensing arrangements, which we don't hear about on the news all the time. And I'm sure that there are quite a few of those arrangements going on.
any last thoughts on this?
also.
David?
All set.
Okay, so our next story is kind of an interesting copyright case. A New York-based photographer, Taya Thale, is suing Apple for use of one of her copyrighted photos in a television ad. So this is a copyrighted photo of the band She and Him. Apple is demonstrating a use of the iPhones and use of it specifically in identifying a song from a band and then buying tickets from a band. The phone navigates either to an app put out by a concert promoter or a website. It's a little unclear from the ad itself where it's going to, but on the iPhone and it's flashing on the ad for, I don't know, probably about a second total, is this picture of M Ward and Zooey Deschanel, who make up the duo She and Him. The photographer claims that that photograph was never licensed for anything other than magazines and posters, and that because Apple used it in an advertisement without getting first permission from the photographer, that Apple has committed some form of copyright infringement. It's an interesting claim, and I can't say for sure that it's frivolous. Do you guys have any initial thoughts on this?
I was trying to figure out what the image was, because the blog post that we were looking at in our email thread this week, it wasn't really clear which image was hers.
It's the video at the end. So basically, when you go to buy the song on iTunes, you'll see a picture of the band. She took a picture of the band. That picture is what she took, and it's being showed in iTunes right before you purchase.
No, it's not though. So sorry to kind of steamroll you there, but
Nope.
There's an album cover which is perfectly all right, and then there's a little thing that pops up that says there's a live concert featuring this band, which I guess directs them to an app in which they can buy tickets for the band. And in the
Sorry.
app, it's about 23 seconds in, you can see it. 23 to 25, I guess.
Yeah,
you can
my
see
bad.
this picture.
Yeah, it's the same photo, but I thought it was iTunes, but you're right. It's the ticket purchasing app.
Right. If it was iTunes, I don't think it would be a problem because the label would own the rights to what to that cover image, to that album art. And I'm sure Apple has cleared licensing with that. I mean, or else God knows. I mean, they must have cleared licensing for that type of thing just to sell it in iTunes. So yeah, it's in. Again, it's not very clear. It looks like it's in some app. So you know, my first question is whether or not Apple has any sort of indemnification policy for, you know, keeping Apple free and clear of any content submitted in an app. And even if, you know, if there were some sort of indemnification policy, if that would even apply here.
And we think that the work was submitted with an app to the App Store?
No, and my guess is the app was submitted and the app pulls this information from somewhere else. So either the record label or the concert promoter was using this image allegedly without permission. Apple then, in creating their ad, chose she and him, you know, chose this app to feature, and, you know, as a result of choosing those, happened to pull this information that the concert promoter came. But, you know, I don't know that Apple, that doesn't seem to protect Apple. The fact that they didn't realize that they were using an unlicensed image is no defense to copyright infringement.
Ah, I see. Yeah, interesting. Interesting problem here. Well, yeah, it might not protect them. I mean, they might be able to sue the promoter if there was something that made Apple think that it was okay to use that image.
Right, if there's some sort of indemnification policy between the promoter or between the, you know, person who submitted the app and Apple, you know, there'd be some protection there. You know, the other thing that I don't know when the last time you know, this was upheld. I mean, so the first argument they could use is that it's some sort of fair use. It's a tiny image. It's being used, you know, it's for commercial purposes, but it's, you know, it's not really to be used as a photographic piece of art. It's used in promoting a band. I don't know how strong that fair use argument is. Another thing you could argue is that it's a de minimis copyright infringement, which, you know, I don't know when the last time a court cited in a positive way de minimis copyright infringement, but it's a theory that basically says, listen, you know, yes, we used your picture, we're sorry, it was a tiny version of the picture that was on screen for a total of about 3 seconds. That's not really enough to warrant you getting some sort of damages for it. And I don't think that's a particularly strong argument, but it's certainly one that, you know, Apple could try to make.
Yeah, that's another fair point. I don't really see this as being a very difficult copyright case. I mean, it's pretty clear that they used the image. They didn't have the rights to use the image, and now it's sort of the question of whose fault is it and who should pay. But also the fair use point. That's another interesting point. I could see a court saying that might be a fair use. It would mostly hinge on how, you know, I mean, it doesn't really seem to be a very transformative use, especially if you're using the entire work, and then, you know, the nature of the work is just a picture of the band. I don't know. It's a tricky question. I bet that Apple wouldn't be willing to figure out whether that defense would actually fly in court. They'd, for something that small, maybe they could just do away with it and settle out of court.
Yeah, agree to pull the ad and give the person a certain amount, give the photographer a certain amount of money to go away, and I don't know, maybe give a stern talking to somebody in the to somebody in their legal department who failed to get clearance for this. That being said, I don't know who could have foreseen this problem cropping up.
I guess the more general question is, does Apple have to secure rights before getting a TV ad? Like, say they're showing the Flickr app in an ad about the iPhone, and while they're browsing through the Flickr app, they show a photo that's copyrighted isn't under a Creative Commons license. That is copyright infringement?
Unless it's fair use, and, you know, even then, depending on who you ask, it's either a defense to copyright infringement, which means it is infringement, but it's fair use, or, it's fair use, therefore it isn't copyright infringement.
Well, it could also be a contract violation because Creative Commons is basically a licensing arrangement, and under those terms, you can choose the terms as you wish, but one set of terms is for you can use it, but only for non-commercial purposes. And so if someone had a CC license work that was non-commercial uses were permitted, that would still give rise to a breach of contract claim.
I mean, has that ever been tested in court? Do we know whether or not it's, and I'm blanking on the term right now, whether it's a condition or a covenant?
I don't think it has been tested
in court, yeah.
And to clarify for the listeners, a condition, am I going to screw this up? A condition of the contract means if you violate the condition, the result was copyright infringement. A covenant is something that you promise to do, and if you break that promise, it's breach of contract and not copyright infringement.
I tend to look at this, though, as being a contract claim and not a copyright claim, because really copyright claims deal with the exclusive rights, and one of the exclusive rights isn't whether it's used for commercial purposes. It has to be kind of tied back into one of those exclusive rights in some way.
That's interesting. Okay.
But I don't think that this is that. I don't think the non-commercial term has been tested in court under a Creative Commons license, so I don't know that there's even any clear precedent to that. But again, we're like we're lost in hypothetical land here anyway. another interesting spin on that though would be what if Apple had used an image from Flickr that was Creative Commons, but there was no commercial or non-commercial restriction on it, and then the license at some point changed because the user decided that he wanted to license it only for reuse under non-commercial purposes. And during that time, Apple had used the picture in one of their ads and then continued to use it even after the licensing change. That's something that people talk about as being a potential problem when you're thinking about, as a lawyer, as you're thinking about how do I make sure that I have copyright clearances and that I will continue to have them in the future. And most interpretations, I think, have been that once you mark something Creative Commons, it's pretty much perpetually Creative Commons, and under that license that you first granted to it, that will always stay with that work.
That's interesting, because I can see a very... that first case that you gave where Apple pulls it when it's, Creative Commons, totally, well, either copyleft or totally, Creative Commons, you can use it however you want. But if, that person then changes it, I go to their website, see the content under the new license, pull it down, I shouldn't still get the benefit of that initial license. That doesn't make any sense because I had noticed that it was now being offered under a different license.
That's mostly, I view that as being like a factual claim that you would have to sort of duke it out in court. Do you have evidence of all of the things that you just said there, that you were aware that the work had been licensed under different terms previously, and then, you were sort of willfully blind to that fact, or however?
That's fair.
But nonetheless, those are perpetual licenses, which makes them particularly hard to revoke. And I know that Creative Commons often takes the position that their licenses are not revocable once you have, once you've put your work out there under a CC license, it will pretty much always have those terms apply to it.
Okay. Any last thoughts on this, Dominic?
All set here.
David?
All set here as well, and I'll take us away to our last story, which is more of an update than a story. This is the Zadeva case. We talked about this, I think, back in April. Now, Zadeva is a new startup that launched a service in March of this year, and basically it's a sort of a DVD rental streaming model. It's a little bit unusual. The owners of the site, or the operators of the site, I think, believe that they're taking advantage of a loophole in copyright law. But as we found out this week, that might not be true at all. And they were sued for copyright infringement. Let me tell you a little bit about how their model works. They purchased a number, hundreds, according to the court filings, hundreds of DVD players and DVDs. And what they offer for users is you can create an account on their site, and you can rent movies to stream. And the model is for every movie rental, I think you pay $1.99, and for 10 movie rentals, you pay $10. And once you've rented something, you have access to it for a 14-day period, and you have access to a particular DVD player and DVD at the Zadiva headquarters. And what they do is they sort of put in the DVD to a particular DVD player that's assigned to each user once they have initiated a rental, and then they've sort of rented out that DVD and DVD player for a 4-hour period at any given time. And when you click play on your screen, and this is of course a streaming model, so you're probably watching it right in your web browser, it sends a signal back to the Zadiva headquarters, which then initiates play on the DVD player, and then you get to sit and watch your movie. And I think you have access to this 4-hour block anytime in that 14-day period. Now, the catch to all of this is that, and what makes it so attractive is that Zadiva is offering these rentals for a much lower price than you would get from, say, Amazon or from iTunes. And they're also doing it without any licensing whatsoever. So their margins would be much higher than I think Amazon or iTunes or Apple with their online streaming services. So of course the movie studios were unhappy about this, and that's where the lawsuit was filed in April for copyright infringement. And I think that from the get-go, most legal commentators believed that this model wasn't going to go anywhere. And we found out this week that the judge also believed that this model wouldn't go anywhere because he issued a preliminary injunction in the case, which is usually a very, very bad sign for most litigants. They tried to defend on grounds that this wasn't a public performance, which is one of these key exclusive rights under the Copyright Act, which says that a copyright owner is, you know, has the exclusive right to initiate public performances of their work. And for movies and motion pictures, that also includes, there's some statutory language to this effect, transmissions of copyrighted works. And I think that this model actually fits pretty clearly into this. There's some very murky doctrinal precedent in some previous cases, some of which we've discussed on our show, that sort of involve streaming models and DVRs and set-top boxes. But in this case, the judge really didn't find any exceptions for the defendants. And the result of the preliminary injunction is that Zadiva will have to shut down their service for now, although they can continue to go forward if they so wish and litigate the case. But the preliminary injunction is issued sort of at the outset of the litigation. So, any thoughts from the panel on either the service or the judge's opinion?
Loophole closed.
Yeah, and Dave, you alluded to some streaming precedents. I think what you were talking about was the Cablevision case, and their Cablevision had set up a remote DVR where, you know, somebody in their living room could hit record, and that would trigger a recording to be made of, you know, that show on a Cablevision server that somebody could then stream from the server, remote server, to their, you know, set-top box. I think the distinction that the judge made was that in the Cablevision case, there was an individual copy of that created for each person who hit the record button. Meanwhile, in this case, there was one copy that was being repeatedly played to many people, although not at the same time.
Right, and then the other streaming cases I was alluding to were actually some of these older cases that involve hotels and the systems that they use to distribute motion pictures to their guests that are staying in rooms.
Right, and those were usually with like a bank of VCRs, and in that case, those were held to be public performances, again, even though it was only one at a time.
Right, and so for Zadiva's purposes, they tried to rely on some of the precedent that says that activity to that nature isn't really a public performance, but the court sort of very quickly and swiftly does away with that, and they just say, you know, and the way that the Act defines public performance, I don't have the language in front of me, but I'm just going from recollection, it says that it has to you have to be transmitting it or playing it before an audience that is more than just like a family in a living room with their acquaintances. And with the language that the judge uses in the case is that this is absolutely public performance because of the commercial relationship that Zadiva has with their subscribers. legal doctrine aside, if you just sort of casually think about what Zediva was doing, they're buying up physical DVDs and then lending them out. And then part of the lending process is also this streaming process. But it wouldn't be so bad if I lent some of my Blu-ray DVDs to Ben to watch, and he then gave it back those DVDs back to me at the end of a week or 2 weeks or 3 months. I have lent that one copy. I'm not creating any additional copies, and I'm sort of allowed to dispose with a particular embodiment of a copyrighted work as I wish after I've already purchased it, because I don't owe any royalties to the copyright owners. I don't owe any royalties back to the copyright studios if I lend it out to Ben for no money. But where that sort of goes awry, I think, for Zediva is also in the fact that they're sort of avoiding these very high licensing arrangements that some of the other startups, like Netflix, for instance, had to deal with early on. Now, if I do remember it, Netflix actually started on sort of this model of like, we're going to buy DVDs up and then send them out through the mail physically, and then they later evolved into a sort of a complex licensing arrangement with the content producers to actually be able to stream to their subscribers. So it changed a little bit over time, but right now they pay a lot of money in order to get the licensing rights that they're required to have in order to stream. And that's also probably the same reason that some of our Netflix subscription fees have been going up or are about to go up in September. In any case, though, what Zediva is doing here, and why I think they believe that they are being so clever, is that once they have purchased a single DVD, they don't have to worry about any of those licensing rights, at least according to themselves, and their own interpretation of copyright law. They're effectively circumventing licensing fees that other streaming models are forced to enter into with the copyright owners.
Yeah, the recent decision by Netflix to split how it's charging with it for streaming or for mailing, I think, came from because they were streaming their licenses basically capped how many people they could stream to, and they were reaching that point from what I understand, and that's why they split it off to lower those numbers until they can renegotiate their licenses.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's pretty difficult these days to just, create your own streaming startup without the blessing of one of those very large, production studios. That Hulu, I can't remember, did Hulu start under NBC or were they later acquired by NBC? But they also had similar difficulties when they started.
Yeah, they started as a collaboration between NBC and a bunch of other networks, and then they were later spun off, or are about to be spun off. I don't know exactly where that is, but they
Yeah.
started as a subsidiary.
So, does anyone want to make any predictions about what Zediva might do at this point in the case and what other remedies that they might have after the preliminary injunction?
Appeal the PI as quickly as they can, and then either continue to be in business or go out of business, depending on, what the appeals court says.
Yeah, if they don't win their appeal, they're pretty much screwed, right?
Yeah, one of the things that a plaintiff has to demonstrate upon asking the court to enter an order for preliminary injunction is that they have to show a very high likelihood of success on the merits of the case. And this was a 12-page order that was issued in this case, and it looks like a pretty nuts and bolts application of the standing precedent that exists. And it wasn't a very surprising opinion for most people, I think, legal commentators included. But what if, though, this case were a little bit different, and what if the DVDs were more like a Netflix model, more like a Netflix model, and were actually being mailed to each subscriber? What do you think happened? What would happen in that kind of a case?
Probably still the same issue because it would qualify as a public performance, no?
Well, I mean, more like the Netflix model where they send you a DVD in the mail.
Right. Does first sale apply? I think is the question that Dave's asking. So if I go out and buy a DVD, does first sale prevent them from going after me if I then rent it out for profit to other people? And I don't think it does, because I recall that, Netflix, they did start by doing that, and then they had to negotiate with the with the labels, and not the labels, the motion picture associations and the various studios to kind of make up for the fact that they had just gone out and bought standard commercial versions and then were renting them out for profit.
Yeah, my understanding is that renting movies is its own sort of beast in terms of copyright law.
Well, don't forget Redbox, which also just went through that very same problem, and I think they settled their most of their cases last year, if I remember correctly, in 2010 sometime. But their model was basically we will go out and buy up large volumes of used DVDs from when Blockbuster sort of has those sales where it's been so long since I've walked into a Blockbuster, but the last time that I did, they would have racks of DVDs for sale, usually of movies that had come out sometime in the last 12 months or so, but had sort of gotten past that new release point where they didn't need a large volume of DVDs to satisfy demand, and they would put them on sale for like $6 or $7. And the Redbox model was sort of like, okay, let's go out and let's buy these things up, and we'll put them into these Redbox machines in your local grocery store, and then you can rent, you can have a movie rental for a very small fee, and usually a smaller fee than you would have to pay than if you went to, say, Blockbuster. And the lawsuits there were kind of similar in that it was kind of viewed as a like a licensing circumvention in order to get around these very expensive licensing arrangements. Going out and buying up large volumes of DVDs and then sort of turning it into a business model. Because the case settled, I don't know that we ever, there might have been one or two opinions on the merits, I can't remember now. But I know that many of the lawsuits actually had settled out of court. So in some cases, we don't know what actually would have happened there. But there were some sort of antitrust claims, counterclaims that Redbox had made in that case, saying that it was just it basically a restraint on trade to try to restrict through using copyright law, trying to restrict the Redbox model like that.
Right. So the other claim that Redbox was trying to make was the studios didn't want to sell Redbox new releases. They wanted to delay new releases for, I forget, 21 or 28 days before they'd let distributors sell those videos to Redbox. And Redbox was also claiming that that was anti-competitive. On a side note, though, is one of us going to have to tell David that Blockbuster filed for Chapter 11 and isn't around anymore?
It's heartbreaking.
They still exist in some form, right?
I don't think so. I don't think they have any physical stores anymore, at least.
You know what's actually sad? I should know that because I'm pretty sure my girlfriend worked on the bankruptcy.
Yeah, and there at least used to be a Blockbuster right on I won't name the name of
Massa.
your street, but yeah, Mass Avenue where your
Yeah,
place.
it's gone now. That has been replaced with something else.
Massive doesn't really narrow it down, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. But if we narrow it down to places on Mass Ave where there were formerly Blockbuster videos, we still don't really have a good idea of where he lives.
Yeah.
So I guess like the other thing that I think is sort of interesting about the Zadeva model is the fact that they bought up so much infrastructure. They bought hundreds of DVD players and hundreds of DVDs, and they had set up a back-end architecture to make all of that work technically. And just thinking about the expense of like buying all these DVD players, I mean, DVD players really aren't all that cheap these days. You end up paying between $100 and $200 for the low-end models with just basic feature sets. Although I'm sure that, they maybe buying in volume, they got some discounts. But it's kind of funny to me that if you consider for every subscriber that wanted to rent a particular DVD, they had set aside a DVD player and a DVD at any given time that person requested to stream a DVD. And yet they were still making money off of a service that only charged $1.99 per viewing, which is just weird to me. And
At the very least,
part of
that's
that, though, is.
impressive.
Yeah, and part of this, though, is the fact that your DVDs and optical media, I mean, they do degrade over time, but you can reuse them again and again and again. So as long as you get, 15 or 20 people per DVD to have watched or to have purchased a rental through their service. I guess you make your money back, at least on the DVD. Kind of at scale, I guess there is a larger margin there, but it's also interesting that you have to consider that all the they had to purchase in order to make everything work, it still would have been way more expensive for them to enter into licensing agreements with the content producers themselves. It really says worlds about what it's like to work with content producers and how expensive it actually is to obtain licenses for stuff like that.
Anything else on this story?
I'm all set.
Dominic, any
All
final
set here.
thoughts? On that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's show. As always, you can find our blog and podcast on the web at technicallylegal.org, on Twitter as @techlegal, and feel free to send comments and story suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Gravier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And one final note, before we let you guys go, we will be off next week. Everyone is pretty much on vacation. One last hurrah before the summer ends. So we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care.